Tonight, an incredible story. A 28-year search for future energy and propulsion designs initiated by an investigation into a UFO story. Up next, Dr. Thomas Vallone and you on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Thomas Vallone, president of Integrity Research Institute, editor of Future Energy Newsletter and eNews, providing consultations on electrical product design and development, engineering, testing, environmental, electromagnetic field energy. Tonight we're going to talk some real point science, zero point energy, and some other issues. Dr. Tom Vallone. Hey, Tom, how are you?
Good, George. How are you?
Good. It was good to see you at the X conference.
Yes, I was happy to be there, and you've certainly entertained the audience, too.
I had a great time. That conference was well put together by Stephen Bassett, don't you think?
Absolutely. He deserves lots of credit.
Have you gone to many of them, or was that your first?
No, I've been there several times. It's in my neighborhood, so I've known Steve for years, and he does a great job.
What did you like about this year?
Well, seeing Ed Mitchell was wonderful. And in fact, that ties me into my first story about the homopolar handbook. I got Ed's picture in the book.
Okay, tell us about that.
Well, 1980 was the date, and I happen to know of a mutual friend, George Land, who was an author, and he basically, once I found out that the book called Sunburst, Return of the Ancients had just been published by Norman Paulson. I ordered the book, looked through it, and saw half of it was all about a UFO story. And the other half was about Yogananda, who was interested in, too. And so I contacted the organization and arranged to go out there for a few days and see a generator they had built based on the on-ship experience that Paulson described in detail. And to me, it was kind of exciting because I'm a scientist, physicist, and always looking for the details of how technically we can benefit from ETs. You know, ET stories are great, but if we don't improve our lifestyle, we're still going to be in the Stone Age compared to them.
Absolutely.
And so I got to gain their confidence while I was there and finally saw what they called the Sunburst Machine.
All right, let's go back a little bit, Tom, and tell us about the UFO story specifically.
Well, it's quite, as I say, it's quite involved. The book is still available. There's several versions of it. I think Christ Consciousness is the latest title he's used. But the important part about the story is that it originated from his visitations to Giant Rock, George Van Tassel's old Integratron, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I have a story about it, the Integratron as well, and that ties me into the bioelectromagnetics field. But it's interesting enough, Paulson spent quite a while out at the Integratron in Giant Rock, and of course this was the 1950s and 1960s when they actually had UFO visitations whenever they had a conference. And in his book, which I still show as one of my slides in my slideshow, and I showed it at the X conference, is a picture in a daylight. This is California, mind you. Sunshine, very bright, and yet brighter than that is a oval-shaped UFO hovering right above Giant Rock. And you can see it looks like a lit type of plasma that's extending down from beneath it. And next to that photo is the picture of Deputy Sheriff holding the photo, because he took it. I mean, talk about authenticity.
Yeah, you talk about credibility, right?
Exactly, yeah. And so this was the kind of experience that Paulson, and I've talked to other eyewitnesses, too. Bob Beck was a good example. I don't know if you ever had Dr. Bob Beck on the show while he was still alive, but there's plenty of people that had seen UFOs at Giant Rock. But a long story short, Paulson starts to describe the experiences on his own of seeing these ships, and then, of course, finally getting the mental contact that's necessary to interest them in landing and then inviting him above aboard the ship. And what I did is I quoted three pages of his book in my book, The Homopolar Handbook, which you can order from Amazon or even from our 888 number, 802-5243. And the important thing was he was given a royal tour, according to his story. And the specific part that I thought was fascinating is the details about how the ship was powered.
Which really doesn't come out in other UFO cases. This was one of the first and probably continues to be one of the best in terms of describing the propulsion system, right?
I believe so. In fact, I have to give Wendell Stevens credit in some of his books for including technical details, audio analysis, and so forth. But you're absolutely right. It's very rare and far, few and far between do you get the details that Norman Paulson related. And so specifically, the description was that there were two rotating disks the size of the ship. And the ship could have been anywhere from 50 feet to 100 feet in diameter. That's the estimate of size that's reasonable from the description and the photos, are actually the photo and the drawings that he includes in the book. And so the rotating disks, one of them was described as producing electricity, and two of them, they were coaxial, rotating in opposite directions, presumably horizontally. The two of them together were producing the anti-gravity effect. And one important detail was that they had 12 magnets around the outer edge.
So this just sounds just like Edward Leedskalnin and his Coral Castle project, doesn't it?
Oh, that's another whole topic. That's a miraculous event there, and certainly lots of theories about how he could have built that.
Now, Van Tassel's Integratron, I remember seeing a picture, maybe this is one of them you have, of it was a black and white picture. He was standing up next to it out there in the desert, and it looked like it was on a stand or a tripod, right? And when he turned this thing on, what did it do?
Oh, well, the Integratron is a building that's about 50
feet tall. But didn't he have a machine that he had on a tripod?
Perhaps when he was first proposing the building itself. But no, the Integratron is literally a building that holds maybe 100 people. And it's currently owned by a couple of former nurses, and they have meetings there all the time.
Okay, I thought he also had a small device that he also called the Integratron back in the 50s.
Well, that's possible. In fact, in the 70s, I received his newsletters and kept track of how he was building the Integratron building itself with the atmospheric electricity. And it looks like a Tesla coil design on the inside with a primary coil around the post, the central pillar, and then the pancake coil around the floor of the second floor.
Okay, in this propulsion system that has been built, was it functional, or did it just look like a scale model?
Well, now we're going back to the Paulson story and the homopolar handbook design. Well, the Sunburst machine itself was a homopolar generator. And for your listeners who may not know, most people don't know what homopolar is, Faraday discovered this back in 1831, it turns out. And it's simply a cylindrical magnet that spins along its axis. And yet, you can get electricity from the center and the outer edge. And I always, in any talk I give on the subject, say, just like the Earth, because the Earth, between the pole and the equator, produces a huge voltage that the aurora borealis actually helps power that electrical flow as well. So we have a homopolar generator in the core of the Earth, and it's a very fundamental design. The interesting thing was I was able to convince my physics professor back at the State University of New York at Buffalo to let me build one for my master's project in physics.
Did it work?
Oh, yeah, it worked. And we're talking 1986 here, 84 to 86. I did it for 2 years, worked on it. And I really was testing for what's called back torque. In other words, Bruce De Palma is still a legend, and he convinced lots of investors to let him build one more homopolar generator after another. And at the time, when I got involved with him, he was being offered two different deals. One was from a doctor in Atlanta, and the other was from Ed Mitchell and George Land. And yet Ed Mitchell was smart. He got a PhD to do some analysis, some due diligence, mm-hmm. and warned him that this was a conventional design. So I took that to heart, and then I said, well, if there is any free energy here, it's going to have to overcome the back torque or simply not have any slowing down effect. In other words, like a motor normally has a back EMF, while the generator, like this homopolar generator, has back torque.
All right, now, go ahead.
Yeah, and I measured it. Whenever you pull current from it, it produces the opposite force to slow itself down.
All right. Now, with this energy generator that you built, what'd you do with it after you were finished with it?
Oh, it's still in my garage. I still have it as a souvenir, as a, you know, kind of a historical landmark of where I was and where I started. But the story continues, and that's why at the X conference I did an hour and a half presentation on the energy technology of UFOs, because it's sort of a journey, a 28-year journey for me that continued every year into more developments. And see, in the back of my mind, I kept thinking, where is this disc with 12 magnets around the outer edge? Mm-hmm. Because the homopolar doesn't have that. And Paulson, when I talked to him, admitted it. He said, but I let De Palma build it anyways. You know, and I was thinking, why? Because this isn't quite exactly what you saw on the ship. So so as things have developed, I got involved with John Searle, actually, because I went to the Germany conference that De Palma was supposed to go to. And I went in his place. It was the gravity field conference that Hans Nieper held back in 1980 in Hanover. And it was my first trip to Germany, and it was very exciting to meet some very illustrious scientists over in Europe, including John Searle. And I don't know if you've had John Searle on your show, but the Searle effect is phenomenal. I mean, to talk about any type of... see, Searle had a UFO experience when he was young and then started building these things that looked like flying saucers afterwards. And specifically, they had electrical output and anti-gravity effect. And so the combination has always intrigued me, because I thought, this is what flying saucers, UFOs, really must possess to be self-sufficient out in space.
Well, do you think we've got this kind of technology out there now?
I knew you were going to ask that.
Oh, yes.
Well, as a matter of fact, I've got several answers for that. And the short answer is yes. The one of the best stories I can relate to kind of proving it, because people like proof, you know. We do, on IntegrityResearchInstitute.org, we do a news service every month. I send out Future Energy E-News. I've done it for...
That's your E-News, right.
Yeah, back in 2005, September 8th, 2005, you can go back in the archives and find this E-News, and I just printed it out tonight because I thought this question might come up. The lead story that I printed then was English words identified on a triangular craft.
Ah, how about that?
And this is a detailed eyewitness account from Comanche County in Texas by a fellow with a high-powered rifle, Remington 700, and as he's looking through the sight, he sees a UFO, but because the sight is so good, he's able to get adjustable magnification from 4.5 up to 14 times that of natural image. And he took his eyeglasses off and wiped his face and so forth, because it was kind of hot there, and he couldn't, when he took his glasses back on, he saw what he believed was a UFO. But then as he looked through the sight, he started to focus in on it, and he could see the markings, a distinct marking. And underneath it said, emergency release and rescue. And the words, basically, it also said pull for, and he recognized this was a military machine and no flying saucer.
How big was this triangle?
Well, he doesn't specifically say. But,
okay, because you do know we've had reports of huge triangular-shaped objects, and I'm wondering if that possibly could be it.
Well, and to answer that question, and I've heard many eyewitness stories to this, is that there probably are a lot of different generations of this type of craft. In fact, in my slideshow, I also, this was just on UFO hunters as well. My slide was also used on that show, and it's specifically from Bruce Carnett. Professor Bruce Carnett has a wonderful archive of material. But one of his team members took a photo with a 35-millimeter camera on a tripod at night, and right outside the Stewart Air Force Base, on one of their trips. And basically, he photographed with an open shutter the triangular craft with two lights on it as it was traveling overhead, and then all of a sudden did a right-hand turn and continued to continue to follow.
Yeah, and we know no conventional craft could just do a right-hand turn.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing was, you see in the photo the red and green blinking lights on the tail and the wingtips. So it's you know, imitating the conventional craft, and yet it's performing unconventionally.
Tom, if we had this craft, if we had it and it was built, when would it have been made, do you think?
Oh, well, actually, one of the standard answers the military will give you when you talk to them, and I have, is that anything you see flying around is 20 years old. And it's probably going to be another 10 years or so before it's declassified.
Okay.
So the military, and this...
And we've been seeing this thing for maybe 10 years now, haven't we?
Oh, I've got in the same 2005 e-news, I have a link to the NIDS report on black flying triangles, where they did a whole report.
I remember that.
Yeah, and the Discovery Institute did a great service in identifying all the details of just that. And that was 4 years ago, you know, 4 years ago.
Well, if we have this kind of propulsion system, this anti-gravity kind of propulsion, and I want you to elaborate a little bit more for us on how you think it works. But if we have this capability, is it functional and is it in use in outer space, for example, by us?
Well, actually, there's I would say yes, because I was at the Disclosure Project in 2000.
Yes,
and it's
Stephen Greer's,
right? And I met some of those people are still my close friends. Mark McCandlish is a good example. Mark was kind enough to include his presentation, which was written up for the Disclosure book that Stephen Greer published, in my Electrogravitics 2 book, which you can get also from the 888 number, 802-5243, or the website. But the important thing is his report at the end of the book specifically has, and this is fascinating to me because this proves what I just said about the things you see flying around, what he called an electrogravitic craft demonstration at the Norton Air Force Base in 1988. And what the story is that he relates in detail is that the craft is flat-bottomed, and it basically has a bunch of capacitors along the bottom that are fired in a pulsed fashion. And they're fired in a very symmetrical fashion so that it keeps pulsing, producing some type of force downward, and therefore creating buoyancy for the what's, mm-hmm. You have to call it a hovercraft. And the story goes that a congressman visited this hangar in California, sunshine again, during the day with a couple other associates, and Mark McCandlish was invited, but he was busy that day for some project, and so he followed up with everyone who had been there, including calling the congressman's office and thanking them for the for being there and confirming it. In other words, everything he did afterwards was to confirm the details, and he has a detailed drawing of this thing, too. The point of me mentioning it is that, number one, the rivets on this thing, he says, look like 1950s rivets. And 30 years later, they're actually showing it, finally.
Well, why, Tom? Why are we... If we have this kind of technology and we can use it for space travel, why the heck are we using conventional propulsion systems, for example, to get the shuttle up and everything else?
Well, you're getting me into a territory that I try to avoid, and that is the black government and the black projects. I mean, I actually do have a part of the presentation is on the new book that Paglen just produced.
Okay, let me ask you that again when we come right back. Dr. Tom Vallone, our guest on Coast to Coast AM. Well, pick up the After Dark newsletter or renew when that renewal comes up, and you get a free CD of J.C. Webster just doing what he does. Just call 1-888-727-5505 to order, or then you know you have your own renewal notice, or go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dr. Tom Vallone. Website is linked up there at coasttocoastam.com. Tom, we were talking about the possibility of black ops projects, and are you uncomfortable talking about it because of what it is or because you just might not know a lot about it?
Well, actually, I do. I have to say that I do know some things about it, and I'm happy to tell you a couple anecdotes that will show that. But also remember, I should give a disclaimer because I do work for the government part-time now.
All
and
right.
Anything I say is my own private voice opinion and not reflecting anything dealing with the government.
There you go. That's fair enough.
But the interesting thing is years ago, this is about 5 years ago, our institute had a seminar with Martin Fleischmann. Fleischmann and Pons, the inventor and discoverer of cold fusion.
Yeah.
Well, Martin Fleischmann was here in the Washington, D.C. area, and we were able to catch him for a private seminar after he visited the Naval Research Lab. And he gave a nice presentation. We have it on video. The important thing was, after he gets to dinner, then he says, I'll tell you a spook story. You know, not on camera, off camera. And I relate it in my book, the Electrovitics book, actually the Zero Point Energy book as well. And the interesting thing is this reflects what I believe the black ops are good at. Here he is at the 1989 press conference for the cold fusion at the University of Utah. And he has to fly to San Francisco to catch his plane to England. You know, that's the way the airlines work. And he misses his connection. And he says, so I had to check into a hotel overnight, and as I'm opening the hotel door, the phone rings. And he walks over to the phone to answer it, and guess who's on the other line? He says, this is Edward Teller. Don't hang up. I have a question for you.
Oh, my.
And Edward Teller, of course, is the father of the H-bomb.
He sure
and
is.
And has always been involved in all kinds of stuff, including Area 51, recruiting Balthazar, and so forth. So the important thing was he asked the discoverer of cold fusion, can you make a bomb from cold fusion? And Martin is a pacifist. And the way he answered the question was, he says, I gave him an answer that he wasn't expecting, or he wasn't anticipating. In other words, he wanted to say no, even though during his lecture, which we taped, he was explaining the fact that, yes, under high pressure, there can be explosions. And there have been at major labs around the country, at least three of them.
Sure.
But back then, he didn't want to get involved in anything dealing with the explosive applications. So he discouraged Edward Teller from following that route. But this has been a common thread as far as the security, national security applications of anything with a lot of energy to it, or more even a little bit of propulsion or anti-gravity, as we might call it in some circles.
Okay, so making the assumption... We're making the assumption that we've got this kind of technology. Again, I guess if we're not using it publicly, we're doing it privately,
right,
and we just don't want the world to know about it. Is that possible?
Oh, it's worse than that. I was at the National Space Society conference. I was a speaker there a couple of years ago, and they had an NRO speaker. And, of course, I always pause when I say NRO because most of the audience doesn't even know what it is. But if you watch the show Alias a few years ago, you'll know that NRO is literally bigger than the CIA, National Reconnaissance Office. And it was
obscure. It sounds obscure, doesn't it?
Yeah, they don't make themselves known at all. But they're launching satellites like crazy. And they're in the new Paglen book. I could tell you, but you would have to be destroyed by me. That's literally the title of this new book with all these patches of the black world, many of them from NRO projects that say National Reconnaissance Office right on the patch. So these guys are deep black. And the interesting thing was they actually sent the deputy a director to the National Space Society to give a talk. And this is the most entertaining talk I've ever had. This was all buzzwords saying, and this is literally a quote, we have to have major muscle moves so we can launch a satellite every month. And I'm thinking, who is he talking to? This is a lay audience, the public, and we're not ready to start to help an NRO to get more satellites to spy on us.
This is incredible.
But he's telling the audience that, yes, we have to get all this. Well, just before he went up, there was Dr. Paul Warbos, who I know because we had him as a speaker from the National Science Foundation. And as Paul's giving a talk, he kept pointing to this deputy director saying, and I need some technology that I know you have. And this is the point. If you know what the technology is, specifically because, say, we've seen a triangular craft do a right angle turn, and I handed this guy Bennett Hart is his name, by the way. Bennett Hart was the speaker that they didn't even announce in the program. They just said NRO speaker would be there. And so it turned out to be Bennett Hart. And I caught him. I buttonholed him as he's leaving the auditorium. I always try to do that to major military guys. And so I had a one-on-one with him for a few minutes with my folder with things to give him, including that triangular craft photo showing the right angle turn.
Well, that's how you gave me some material at the X conference.
There you go.
Yep.
And so I'm trying to prove that the lay people, the public already has photographed stuff that proves inertial shielding is real. Now, if people don't know what inertial shielding is, this is something so simple that we should have developed it. And we probably already did because the triangular craft has it. And that is a shield around the vehicle to stop the inertial mass from having any sizable impact whatsoever. And this relates to relativity, and it relates to the fact that inertia has never been defined except as a relationship to the distant stars. See, Dr. Hal Puthoff, who's a good friend of mine, published a physical review article explaining how it's related to zero-point energy. And it has an electromagnetic nature to it.
So, now, this inertial form is necessary, I would guess, for almost any kind of vehicle or craft to propel, right?
Well, it is more specifically for acceleration because it's old Newton's law. You learn in high school, F equals ma. Well,
sure.
The m is the inertial mass, and if m goes to zero or so small you can't even measure it, then all of a sudden your acceleration can be huge, and that's what we see with UFOs.
It's a simple formula, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You just got to figure out how to get to it.
And see, that's what black ops have already done. And that's why we're seeing right angle turns, fast acceleration. I show a video of one UFO which takes off so fast, there's only a couple frames that has the image.
Is this reversed technology from UFO craft, or is it our own development because we have incredible minds?
I think it's the former. I haven't seen too many incredible minds really put their technology to use here. Because technology is the outcome of incredible minds. But see, we're still living in fuel-powered cars, which we invented, last century.
But they want us in these kinds of vehicles.
Okay.
They want us to connect to the power grid. They don't want to give us free energy.
Well, thank you. This is pretty much what I was going to say, but I'm glad you said it for me.
Well, you can say it too and back me up.
And this is probably the conspiracy theory that your listeners always have heard from many other speakers. And there's lots of evidence for that, so I don't need to beat a dead horse.
And this is coming from Dr. Thomas Vallone, Ph.D. I didn't just grab you off the street somewhere. Go ahead.
Well, the other parts of this, and I have this email right in front of me, which is still hot off the press, April 23rd, from a good retired friend of mine from the Center of Technology Commercialization, which is still a NASA spinoff. And my short email from him is describing the fact that a friend of mine called today to tell me about his recent experiences with the government regarding a new unique hydrogen generator he's trying to patent. These actions involve a security and defense hold on his patent, use of technology by the office, restriction and ban from the Pentagon, and a gag order from the NSA regarding discussions with foreign entities. He was taken by the FBI to their headquarters in Newark and interrogated for 5 hours. And now he's trying to get legal assistance.
Another incredible story.
They
don't end.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the patent office has secretized over 4,000 patents. They have representatives from every military agency at the office to screen the patents as they get applied for. So the government really has a stranglehold on new technology, and it basically makes sure it progresses at a snail's pace.
In space, how fast could these anti-gravity devices go, do you think?
Well, now you get me into my latest book, Zero Point Energy, The Fuel of the Future.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I'm happy to say, is a work that's taken me years to produce, but I've put it together in a very readable form. And to answer your question, I always refer to David Fronig's work. And David Fronig has a wonderful slideshow that he gives at the National Space Societies and elsewhere. And he gave me copies of his slides to use. And what he describes is the... Once again, a shielding effect that interacts with the quantum vacuum using a toroidal shape that's, of course, circular. You know, we wonder why UFOs are circular. Well, here's a theoretical description of an advantage that it needs to be circular to have a very high toroidal vector field that actually then reduces the drag.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay.
Yep. And so he describes the fact that the speed of light is just like the speed of sound. And he has graphs and charts to prove the same analogous curves of exponential increase in resistance as you get near the speed limit, and then, of course, the other equations that look identical. So his simulations using this toroidal effect on quantum vacuum actually gets better as you get to colder temperatures near absolute zero. And, of course, outside space is 3 degrees near absolute zero.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, he's describing 2 times the speed of light, 3 times, 5 times, 10 times. He has the simulations to show what that will do to the craft and what the forces will be.
If we can go that fast, are we then indeed time traveling?
Not necessarily. I mean, the standard answer to that, and I know there's people out there that even physicists that are working on the real time travel, but we have to be cagey about it because it's a really a hot potato. Normally, we can anticipate that time will slow down for the traveler. So
right,
he may not
right.
come back to his same family that he's used to. They're probably going to be pretty old when he comes back.
He may end up coming back to the family's offspring, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, and that really has been confirmed with muons, for example, as they hit the upper atmosphere. All of a sudden, we can detect them on the ground because they're traveling so close to the speed of light.
If we have these objects, mm-hmm. if we're going at 2 to 3 times the speed of light, then we have gone to Mars. We had to have.
That's the point. And when you hear the disclosure people, it seems, well, here's a good story that Mark McCandless tells. And this is part of his presentation, actually. I've seen it twice now. He was at the UFO Congress a couple of years in a row. He says, and this was once again in California, and he's talking about an anecdotal experience of a hangar in California that about 2 a.m. Unloads its shroud-covered craft, circular craft, and then it all of a sudden takes off at super high speed. And what does Mark do? He goes and interviews the deputy sheriffs around the neighborhood that block off traffic.
Okay.
And he gets one of them to admit, yeah, we'd block off traffic because they have to, you know, make sure people aren't seeing these things fly away. And Mark says, bingo, I got you. So,
and then he
shows a photo of the hangar, the company's name, the address you can go to, you know. But Nick Cook is a good friend of mine. He's an interviewer from James Defense Weekly.
Yeah, he's been on the program a number of times. Good guy.
There you go. And of course, when you go there and confront the president of Lockheed about the black projects, the answer which he got on film was, well, if it's a white project, we can tell you all about it. And then he says, what about the black projects? And it's no answer.
He just stands there on camera, right?
That's right.
Waiting for his PR guy to come jumping into the film and pushing Nick Cook away.
Exactly.
Not that happened, but you never know.
Yeah.
Well, of all the next hour, by the way, I want to spend some time talking about Tesla.
Okay.
Tesla technology and also this bioelectromagnetic healing that you've written a book on, because I find that to be fascinating. But
absolutely.
Of this field, then, that we're talking about, the zero-point energy, the fuel of the future, what fascinates you, Tom, about all of this? The fact that we have it, it's not being disclosed, but it's being used maybe by the Illuminati or these one world government folks, that we might have been to Mars already, maybe we've landed there. What fascinates you about the secret of all this?
Well, in the zero-point energy inventions?
Yes.
Well, really the fascination is that we can help the planet get off of the fossil fuels. I'm deeply concerned about global warming, and I always show the graphs and charts to show that sea level and temperatures are headed to disastrous levels. And so this is really my, I say my extended family, because I've never fathered kids myself, but I always thought I need to work for the world in this lifetime.
All right, but you're assuming that they are going to let us know about this kind of technology. They may never.
Nope, I presume they won't. Yep, I keep asking for declassification. Oh, I didn't finish telling you a story about Bennett Hart. The bottom line was, after I told him the same thing that Paul Werbos was, that we need the technology, and if you can declassify just the inertial shielding, it'll help the civilian space tourism, and also it'll help you to get your satellites up once a month, because you'll get more bang for the buck.
Of course.
You know what he said? You know what Bennett Hart told me?
What did he say?
He says, that's a classified item you're talking about, and typically what happens though, to that type of device, he says it goes higher and higher in classification levels until it gets out of sight. That's literally a quote from the deputy director of the NRO.
And that's almost like saying it exists, but we can't talk about it.
Well, it gets worse if it keeps going up in classification levels. And then his caveat was, he says it's cheaper, it's easier for us to reinvent it by paying a private contractor to reinvent it, and it'll come out at a lower classification level. Pay for it twice by tax dollars. That's literally what he's asking us to do.
And again, what? This is speculation here.
Yep.
Was this from the Roswell crash? Where did we learn the technology?
Oh, well, there's, according to Bob Lazar, who I've talked to personally, there's plenty of craft that we've captured. I mean, my friend Ryan Wood has conferences every year just on the topic of UFO crashes. And he tells me there's more material out there that you can have conferences for years to come. I keep thinking there's only a few that I know about, but Ryan says, no, there's tons of them, and he can get lots of investigations going. So I think we have to give the military more credit than we have in the fact that at least a couple crashes may have been really retrieved very well, and engineers are busy at work on them and have been.
Why are you allowed to say this without somebody trying to put a cork down your throat?
Well, I think it's very common knowledge nowadays. See, the interesting thing is, you know, when you send out somebody like Stephen Greer as a scout dog, you know, and literally Stephen has paved the way for us, because he's been so confrontational with these guys that he's had them come up to him and threaten him. And that's when you know you're doing something really to get onto their turf.
Yeah, but you're giving us information tonight that we've heard in little bits and pieces, but, I mean, you're putting it all together.
Well, of course, but the fact is it's public knowledge. And also, I tell in my book how you can protect your inventions when you know it's something that's invading into that area that's a little bit possibility of being classified or secretized.
Does anybody else on this country, on this planet, have this kind of technology, or just us, the United States?
Oh, I think every country has got their own secret projects going. And inventors. See, we have inventors in various parts of the world who basically not only have advanced technology, but they tend to be paranoid about it, too. I mean, that's exactly the psychology you see in John Searle. You know, he's a paranoid inventor who, it made him crazy, in other words, the fact that he discovered an anti-gravity and electric device all in one boat.
Your work, your very fine work, you can get off your website, and as you said, Amazon.com. Why don't you give us that toll-free number again, Thomas?
Sure, it's 888-802-5243.
What's the easiest way to get your work? Off the website?
Yeah, it's the IntegrityResearchInstitute.org.
Got to put the org. Mm-hmm. That's the important thing.
That's right.
Next hour, let's talk about bioelectromagnetic healing, how that works.
Okay.
I'm testing a machine now that the folks from the Merlin Project sent me. And, you know, before I talk about anything, I want to see if it works, or I don't want to talk about it. And then we've got Tesla. I want to talk about who I think we have harnessed some kind of weapon from Tesla technology, don't you?
Oh, yes, of course. Many of these things can be weaponized. But I'd like to concentrate on the peaceful, beneficial applications.
All right. Stay with us. Dr. Thomas Vallone. More to come on Coast to Coast AM.